Would you open your Bibles, please, to Matthew chapter 15, verse 29. You know, it's a difficult thing to do, but I want you to imagine that your child is suffering, perhaps even dying from some injury or accident or lifelong hardship, and no one can help him. Imagine looking everywhere desperately for a cure, but you're only met with sad faces, with shaking heads, with downcast eyes. No one can do anything. Then, just as you're about to give up hope, imagine that you hear about a man far away from a country across the lake. I mean, just over there, who is healing people just like your child. But there's just two problems. First, he's too far away and your child can't make it that far. And second, even if he could, this man belongs to a people who you can't easily approach. Your ethnicity and your culture make you unclean and despised by his people. What hope do you have then? The big idea of our text this morning is that Jesus is more than enough for the world. Jesus is more than enough for the world. And I believe this is a theme that's been building for several weeks now in Matthew's gospel. And here's what I mean. 4 weeks ago, if you remember, we saw Jesus feed 15 to 20,000 Jewish men, women, and children. It's the miracle we know as the feeding of the 5,000, because that's how many men were counted there. And the big idea we took away from that story was that even when it's impossible for human resources to meet a need, Jesus is more than enough. But what we need to remember is that that was a miracle done primarily for Jewish people in a Jewish area. Then 3 weeks ago, we saw the Jewish leaders accuse the disciples of being unclean. The disciples weren't following the man-made hand-washing rules that were kind of loosely based on the ceremonial system and were thought to keep you ritually pure and able to worship God rightly. This was because there were many ways to become polluted in God's sight according to the Jewish ceremonial system, such as by touching dead bodies or eating certain foods, or by coming into contact with Gentiles. And so purity laws were another way of keeping the Jewish people separate from the rest of the world. But we learn from Jesus there that it's actually what comes from inside you, from the heart, not what you come in contact with that is outside you, that makes you polluted before God. And so we ask the question, what can a man or woman do to wash clean their polluted inner self? The answer was nothing. Nothing. We can do nothing. The Jews could wash their hands all they wanted, but they couldn't wash their hearts. And that was a problem, and that was the whole point, was that there was a problem. The ceremonial system was a system that was always meant to confront the Jewish people with the truth that in their own strength, they weren't enough to keep themselves clean before God. They needed help. They needed help. And for this help, they needed to humbly seek the mercy of God. Well, then we saw last week that Gentiles need mercy too, don't they? We saw that even though Jesus had come from the Father to be enough for the Jews first, to be the bread of life for them first, we saw last week that God's gracious promises to the children of Israel had always included more than enough mercy for the Gentiles too. And so we saw last week that the mercy of God, the children's bread, is so abundant in Jesus that it spills over to meet the needs of even the Gentile who will come to him, seeking him in faith, seeking help in faith. And one Canaanite woman perceives this. She is commended for her faith, and she goes away having received God's mercy. Jesus heals this woman's daughter, and I believe heals this woman's heart as well. She goes away having fed on the children's bread. So that now in today's text, as if to highlight and apply the truth of God's abundant mercy as broadly as possible, we now have Jesus doing even more miracles among the Gentiles. Except that they're not just any miracles. No, what makes this amazing is that they seem to be miracles that actually mirror the same things Jesus has already been doing among the Jews. They're so similar, in fact, that in some cases, Matthew even writes the accounts of these miracles word for word, the way he wrote about them when Jesus did these things for the Jews. And that's not by accident. Have you ever noticed, for instance, have you ever wondered why there is a story about the feeding of the 4,000 that's so similar to the feeding of the 5,000? I mean, why is that? Why tell the same story twice? It's because what both Jesus and Matthew want us to see is the wonderful truth that's been building since chapter 14, which is that Jesus is more than enough for the world. For the world. Now, when I say world, I mean by it the same thing Jesus meant by it in John 3:16, that God doesn't just love the Jewish people so much that he gave his son, but that he gave his son because he loves the Jewish people and the Gentile people too. Remember, for the first century ethnic Jew, those are the only two categories that existed when it came to the human population. There's us and there's them. There were Jews and there were Gentiles. And as far as most ethnic Jews were concerned at the time, the promises of God were only for the Jews. They were only for the Jews. But now in verses 21 through 39 of chapter 15 especially, Matthew makes it crystal clear that Jesus is more than enough for the Gentiles too. And we know this because in these verses we see Jesus temporarily leave behind ministry in an explicitly Jewish context, in Jewish territories and among mostly Jewish people, to do many of the exact same miracles and ministries now in an explicitly Gentile context, in Gentile territories and among Gentile people mostly, so that what clearly comes across is that in Jesus, there is more than enough power to heal the Gentiles, more than enough compassion to go out to the Gentiles, and more than enough bread to satisfy the Gentiles too. This morning, we're going to see that Jesus is more than enough for the world. And so our text begins where our last story left off, somewhere in the borderlands between Galilee and the regions of Tyre and Sidon, what today would be the mountains of southern Lebanon. Having just healed the daughter of the Canaanite woman, we're told in verse 29, turn there if you are there, we're told there that Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee, and he went up on the mountain and sat down there. Now, if that was all the information that we had, we might not realize at this point that Jesus is still in Gentile territory at the end of that verse. Why wouldn't we realize it? Well, because all Jesus has to do to go from the district of Tyre and Sidon, where he's just been with this Canaanite woman, all he's got to do to go from there back to Capernaum is to pretty much head due south. I mean, it's not really complicated. But instead, Mark's gospel clues us in on a different route that Jesus takes home, and it still leaves him walking beside the Sea of Galilee. But how does Jesus get home according to Mark? In Mark 7:31, we read this. Then he, Jesus, returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to get to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. Mark tells us Jesus makes his way from the district of Tyre towards the Sea of Galilee by going through Sidon. But where is Sidon in relation to Tyre? It's north. It's north. All he's got to do to go home is south, and Sidon is north. North into more Gentile territory. And where is the region of the Decapolis where Mark tells us this journey ends Jesus up, how he ends up there? Where is that? It's It's all the way on the southeastern side of the Sea of Galilee. As another preacher I know has put it, this way of getting back home was something like leaving Orland and going to Red Bluff and then returning to Orland by way of Redding and then Chico. That's pretty much what's happened here. In other words, Jesus isn't taking a direct route home. And in fact, it's only after our story finishes today, the very last verse, after the miracles we're going to look at today, it's only after all that that Jesus finally makes it back into Galilee. And how does he make it there? The text there tells us he gets in a boat and he crosses the lake west toward familiar shores. All of which is to say that I believe the events in our story today take place in Gentile territory on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. And yeah, it's all within the territory of ancient Israel, but Mark clearly identifies this area now as the region of the Decapolis, a region of 10 Greek city-states under the control of the governor of Syria. In other words, this is an overwhelmingly Gentile region. And so it's in the hills of this region, somewhere on the Golan Heights, that Jesus now sits down, and he went up on the mountain and sat down there. You know, the way Matthew words this here seems to intentionally echo his wording back in chapter 5, verse 1 of Matthew's gospel, the place that marks kind of the beginning of Jesus' public ministry among the Jews. There we read, "Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down." And here now, among the Gentiles, Jesus does the same. Likewise, as recent as chapter 14, verses 34 to 36, we read that in Jewish territory, when the men of that place recognized him, they sent around to all that region and brought to him all who were sick and implored him that they might only touch the fringe of his garment. And as many as touched it were made well. And here now, Jesus does the same thing for a great crowd in this Gentile territory. Look now at verse 30. "And great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others, and they put them at his feet, and he healed them." So that now, as if to highlight and apply as broadly as possible the truth that Jesus is more than enough for the world, we see first that in Jesus there is more than enough power to heal the Gentiles too. Now, I'm a stingy person. I admit it. I'm stingy about some things more than others. But I tend to have this default outlook on life that tells me there's not more than enough of anything. There's limited energy in my body. There's limited time in a day. There are houses I've lived in where there is limited hot water that comes out of the shower. And so this outlook tends to result in me trying to be careful. That sounds better than stingy. Me trying to be careful with my time or my energy or my resources. But my family will tell you that there are two things in particular I'm stingy about. The first is food. I don't like to share food. But the second thing is my cell phone charger. I'm very stingy about my cell phone charger. And I'm stingy about it because no matter how many we buy, they just seem to keep disappearing. And then what do people do? They come and they steal mine. They steal my charger, my precious charger. And then what happens? Well, what happens is that my phone dies halfway through the day, and I hate that. And I get grumpy, and they don't want that. And so there's a rule in our house. No one touches Dad's cell phone charger. It stays by the bed, and by the bed it stays. And that is because there is limited power in my phone. But in Jesus, there is no limitation of power. "Is there any limit to my power?" God asks Moses in Numbers chapter 11, verse 23. It's a rhetorical question. The answer is no. And neither is there a lack or shortage of divine power in Jesus. Yes, it's true. In his human nature, he gets tired and he's got to sleep. Yeah, it's true. Touching his human nature, he gets hungry and he's got to eat. But in his divine nature resides the very source of all the power you've ever squinted at under a microscope or gazed at through a telescope and everything else in between. Every cell is propelled by him. Every sun is sustained by him. Every breath is a gift from him. Visible and invisible, all things are sourced and sustained by the power of God the Son. Now, to an extent, it is true that Jesus has prioritized the Jews to receive the mercy of God's healing power. He has prioritized the Jews, but this has never meant that there wasn't enough to go around. Because objectively speaking, in Jesus, there is more than enough power to heal Gentiles too. And now Jesus demonstrates this clearly here. Just look at how he responds to all the needs of the Gentiles who are brought to him, who are described here as the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others, our text says. You know, we can read a list like that and just kind of glaze over, skip right over it. I think we should slow down a minute. The lame seems to refer mostly to those with walking disabilities. This could include the effects of palsy or polio. You know, the U.S. has been, my understanding is the U.S. has been polio-free since 1979 because of the polio vaccine. But where I grew up in Africa, there it was common to see kids and grown-ups going around with a pole, you know, to support them, to drag themselves along, or walking on their hands. It was a common thing. Then there are the blind. They seem to be everywhere Jesus goes. Have you noticed? Everywhere Jesus goes, there seem to be blind people. And while undoubtedly there were some who were born blind, most blindness at that time was probably caused by simple infections that would be no problem to cure today. Simple infections of the eye that were common and basically untreatable until they led many people into blindness. The crippled or maimed were of a similar category to the lame, except that the word here could refer to mutilation, so some sort of accident-related disfigurement as well. The condition could likewise describe any limb, not just the legs. It could be the arms too. And according to the same use of the use of this word in Matthew 18:8, it also refers to amputees. That's interesting. The mute as well, we've already seen in Matthew, can refer to those who are either deaf or dumb or both. This is probably because, as some of you know, early hearing loss that's severe can also lead to speech problems as well. And so the word for mute here in Greek means blunted or dull. It can apply either to dull hearing or dullness in speech, a thickness in your tongue where you can't form words very clearly at all. And so Gentile people with all these afflictions are brought to Jesus. They're led to Jesus. They're carried to Jesus. And the text says, and they put them at his feet. Except that it doesn't just mean they were gently laid down in front of Jesus in an orderly fashion, one at a time. No, the word used here has a graphic sense of being cast down, flung down. It literally means that they were throwing these ones at Jesus' feet. Not carelessly, you understand, but in a rush. Why would that be? Why would that be? Because imagine your child is suffering horribly, perhaps even dying from some injury or accident or lifelong hardship, and no one can help him. And everywhere you look for a cure, you've been met with sad faces, with shaking heads, with downcast eyes. No one can do anything. Yes, you've heard of a man far away from a country across the lake, a man who's healing people just like your child. But there's a problem. There's two. First, he's far away and your child can't make that journey. And second, even if he could make it, even if he could, your culture and your ethnicity make you unclean and despised by his people. They won't help you. And so you've admitted things were hopeless long ago. And then one day you're walking home and you see people running. And you stop, you're confused because they're leading people. They're carrying people. They're dragging people with them. Sick people, crippled people, blind people, people just like your boy. And so you stop one of them, a man leading his blind mother. Sir, you ask, where are you going? The healer, he says, the healer is here. He came here. He came to us. And you stare at him. The significance of what he's saying is still sinking in. And then you're running too. You're running too. You run home. You scoop up your boy. Now you're sprinting. You're stumbling. You are sprinting again for the sake of your child. You are running like you've never run before towards the hills where a crowd is already forming. Because what do you know? Your default outlook on life tells you that there's never more than enough of anything. Everything is limited. Time, resources, opportunity. And so what do you know? Maybe this Jewish healer will change his mind. Maybe he'll run out of patience. Maybe he'll run out of stamina. Maybe his power will be used up before you get to him. What do you know? And the whole crowd feels it. There's a sense of pressure, of anxiety. There's a crush of bodies trying to get close to him. So that all around you, people are rushing forward as soon as an opening appears. They're pressing close, and then they're thrusting their loved ones before him. They're literally casting their cares upon him. Because this man, who is their last and only hope, for the love of God, might heal them. And suddenly you're doing it too. You see an opening and you go for it. You push your way through until suddenly you see a man who looks tired but kind and as if he's been waiting to see you for a long time. Sir, you cry out. You rush forward. You throw your child at his feet. Heal my boy. Heal my boy. And great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others, and they put them at his feet. And what did he do? And he healed them. And he healed them. With 4,000 men plus women and children, there may have been 20,000 people on the scene, writes John MacArthur. With all the sick people thrown at Jesus' feet, you can imagine the chaos. There was no order as this pile of humanity crowded towards him. In spite of that, Jesus healed them. People without arms were going away with arms. People who had lost their eyes were going away with eyes. People who had never spoken were speaking. And people who had never been able to walk were walking. Amen? Look now at verse 31. So that the crowd wondered when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. The crowd wondered, we're told. They were astonished. This word points to having no human explanation for what they were seeing. And what were they seeing? Brokenness mended, tragedy reversed, lives restored. Now, what might surprise you is that there's actually a growing field called disability studies that responds in the world today, that responds very negatively to any idea that disabled people have a need to be restored or fixed in some way. But under the guise of what might at first sound like compassion, this is actually a view that is deeply dehumanizing of individuals. It's dehumanizing in that many in this movement actually consider diagnosing, treating, and curing disabilities as a bad thing. Like giving in to some sort of oppressive trade-off as though being treated or cured were some sort of trick by the rest of society just to create more healthy workers who can now better perpetuate unjust systems to create, you know, it's just, I'm not making this up. This view is dehumanizing of individuals and that it actually has the gall to suggest that disabled people have a duty They have a responsibility to use their disabilities for the sake of their cause. What do they mean by that? What they mean by, how are they supposed to do this? This is what they mean. The advice of this growing ideology is that they do this, they support the cause by refusing attempts at treatment, by refusing a cure as a way to make an ideological statement. But guess what? The people writing these books and formulating these theories don't care about individuals. The people shaming deaf people for getting hearing aids, they don't care about the individuals. They only care about furthering their own agenda, and they do this by using those who suffer most like pawns in some game. But Jesus cares about individuals. Jesus is infinitely concerned with the bodily pain of the world, writes William Barclay. And those who bring men health and healing are still doing the work of Jesus Christ, because he cares about individuals. And that is why the crowd saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing. And they glorified the God of Israel. And quickly here we have another clue in the text that this is a Gentile crowd. By the way, Matthew records their response to the healings. He says they acknowledge the power of whose God? Israel's God. That's not something that a Jewish crowd would say. But we should also notice something about the content of what they've just said. We should notice something about the content. We should notice that these common Gentiles recognize about Jesus something that many of the Jewish elites have failed or refused to acknowledge. And what is that? It's that the God of Israel is with this man. The God of Israel is with him. They that gave glory not to Jesus himself, but to the God of Israel, shows that they have a good understanding of the source from which Israel's Messiah must draw his authority, writes R.T. France. Why is it true that in Jesus there is more than enough power to heal the Gentiles? It is because Jesus is inseparably connected to the God of Israel. And in him there is no limit to power. There is no limit to his power. But secondly now, to highlight and apply as broadly as possible the truth that Jesus is more than enough for the world, we see that in Jesus there is also more than enough compassion for the Gentiles. Look at verse 32. Then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion on the crowd, because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat, and I am unwilling to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way. You know, sometimes you can learn things by what isn't in the text. You can learn something by what's not said. What do I mean? I mean that if you think back to the feeding of the 4,000, this that we're studying right now, if this is meant to take place among Gentiles as an intentional duplication of the miracle done for a similar number of Jews just a matter of weeks before, if this is meant to demonstrate an outpouring and an overflow of the compassion of God in Christ for the world, there are still some glaring differences in the text between these two stories. And one of them is right here. The first of them, other than, you know, the number of people involved in these two stories, is a difference in the attitude of the disciples that is evident in what isn't said here. What do I mean? Well, let me put it this way. Just before the feeding miracle in Galilee among the Jews, guess who were the first to voice compassionate concern for the hungry crowds after only one day of being with Jesus in the desolate wilderness? Who was it? It was the disciples. Now, when it was evening, this is from chapter 14. Now, when it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place, and the day is now over. Send the crowds away to go into the villages to buy food for themselves. But now here they are in the same situation, only this time in the region of the Decapolis and among the Gentiles. And we learn from Jesus that the need for healing there has just been so great, just been so overwhelming, that his ministry to these people has now gone on for 3 days. For 3 days, they've been laying people at his feet. But notice, who speaks up now? for the hungry crowds. Is it the disciples? No, it is not. Their silence is deafening. I would say their prejudice is deafening. Even after Jesus is teaching that what makes you unclean comes from inside you, not from outside you, still they're on edge here among this unclean people. Even after Jesus' interaction and kindness with the Canaanite woman, still they're on edge here among these who they can't help but see as being people outside God's flock. Because I think some ruts in the heart just take a longer time to fill back in than others. And this will take time for them. And there are certain ruts in your heart too, if you're honest, that go deeper than others. There are certain ruts in your heart too that divert the flow of compassion as well. There are certain blind spots, there are certain sins that will take longer for you to see and have filled up by the grace of God, some more than others. But God will find them. He will find them. And he will fill them. Where sin runs deep, his grace is more. Jesus will help you get out of those ruts so that you can increasingly share his heart of compassion for the people around you. And Jesus will help his disciples too. And so this time it is him who calls their attention to the needs of the weary people. Gently, kindly, he points out what they either don't see or don't want to see. And then he declares that in him there is more than enough compassion for the Gentiles too. Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days, and have nothing to eat. And I am unwilling to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way." The word for compassion here literally means to have one's inner being stirred. It's to be moved in the inward parts. It's where we get the idea of a visceral reaction to something, right? Except in this case, it's a warm reaction, a sudden emotional response that is not willing to let a need go, not to let it go unnoticed or unmet. There's an unwillingness there. I've been surprised by this kind of compassion several times. One that came to mind as I was preparing this message was about a year ago in June during our last men's camping trip in the Alps. On that trip, we were hiking in, and I saw a young man at the front of the line as we were hiking single file. And this is a kid that puts on a pretty tough front, a pretty tough exterior. I saw him suddenly stop when he realized that the smallest and youngest boy in the group had fallen to the back of the line. And I watched him, as he realized this, go from the front, run all the way to the back until he caught up with him. And he stayed with that young man all the way till we got to our destination to support him, to sustain him, to encourage him, to keep him company. His compassion was clear. When he realized the boy was getting tired and discouraged, he was unwilling that nothing should be done. And that's exactly the kind of compassion Jesus expresses here. Even after all he's done for these crowds, even now he is unwilling to let their needs go unnoticed or unmet. "I am unwilling to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way," Jesus says. Friends, this is good news for us. This is good news for us because we are the ones lagging behind on the trail. This is really good news for us because we are the ones who would have been standing in that particular crowd. Most of us here are probably Gentiles. And this is good news for us because even after 3 days of nonstop ministry to these people, to people just like you and just like me, Jesus still isn't at the end of his rope. He hasn't come to the end. There's no limit to his compassion because his heart is the very heart of God, and God is love. This means that even after you leave church today, even having been filled spiritually and then filled again physically at our potluck afterwards today, still, God's compassion will follow you home. It will follow you. This means that even if, like some in the crowd, you walk away from Jesus today and you never look back, Even then, if you enjoy one more breath, one more smile, one more meal, it's only because an abundance of Christ's compassion follows you. And so the good news is that even after all the power he's expended on them, even after all the time he's given to them, still the heart of Jesus goes out to these Gentiles. In Jesus, there is more than enough compassion for the Gentiles too. This ought to encourage all who are hesitating about beginning to walk in God's ways, writes J.C. Ryle. Let them remember that their Savior is full of compassion. He will receive them graciously. He will forgive them freely. He will remember their former iniquities no more. He will supply all their need abundantly. Let them not be afraid. Christ's mercy is a deep well of which no one ever found the bottom. It also, he says, ought to comfort the saints and servants of the Lord when they feel weary. Let them call to mind that Jesus is full of compassion. He knows what a world it is in which they live. He knows the body of a man and all its frailties. He knows the devices of their enemy, the devil, and the Lord pities his people. Let them not be cast down. They may feel that weakness, failure, and imperfection are stamped on all they do. But let them not forget that word which says, His compassions fail not. And neither does Jesus' compassion fail here. Because it doesn't stop with mere sympathy. What we see in the text is that instead, it always moves on to a practical response which meets the need. And this is exactly how Jesus responds to this crowd as well. His heart goes out to them, and then he acts on it. Because now the disciples realize Jesus means to feed all these people. Look now at verse 33. And the disciples said to him, "Where are we to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed so great a crowd?" And it's like the movie where the people go into the dark house and they don't turn on the lights, and we're all sitting there watching and we're shouting at them and we're waving our hands in disbelief. We're all sitting here saying to these, we're all like, "Guys, wake up." Because, well, Jesus is patient, and how can he be so patient? But aren't you glad he's so patient? Jesus is patient. Verse 34, Jesus said to them, "How many loaves do you have?" They said, "Seven and a few small fish." I mean, honestly, is it really possible that this isn't jogging any memories for them? You know, does nothing about this scenario seem familiar? Because to me, it feels sort of like not recognizing Superman just because he's wearing a pair of glasses. There's a big crowd on a mountain. Jesus has just healed them. They have no food. You have nothing but a few bread and a few fishes. Oh, right, and also a rabbi who can multiply food. But no, their first thought is, "Where are we to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed so great a crowd?" But thankfully, in Jesus, there is more than enough compassion for the Gentiles. Thankfully, we don't have to wait for the disciples to have compassion. And so while the disciples slowly play catch-up, Jesus quietly goes about his Father's business. While the disciples slowly realize what he's about to do, Jesus goes into miracle mode. So that in verse 35, we see him directing the crowds to sit down on the ground. And so that between verses 36 and 38, we see him repeat, down to almost the identical words, a powerful, compassionate, impossible act on only a slightly smaller scale than the previous feeding of the Jews. There, by the same Sea of Galilee, Jesus does exactly the same thing for these Gentiles that he's already done for the Jews. And once again, just as before, I want you to notice that Jesus doesn't wait for his disciples to actually feel his same compassion for the crowds before he commands them to act with compassion towards the crowds. I want you to notice again that Jesus doesn't wait for them to feel compassion before he commands them to essentially be the hands and feet of his own compassion. No, verse 36 simply says, He took the 7 loaves and the fish, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. I love that he had them give them to the crowds. I mean, that was one thing when it was with the Jews, but this was another thing. What must it have been like for the disciples to serve these Gentiles? I think the sanctified word that we would use is humbling, but the word that might have come to mind for them was something more like humiliating. I don't think it's what they signed up for, honestly. And it's a cautionary tale, I think. Don't let anybody tell you that if you follow Jesus, life will be easy. Don't let anyone tell you that if you follow Jesus, life will be health and wealth and roses. Don't let anybody tell you that if you follow Jesus, life will be all about you fulfilling your deepest dreams and living your best life now. No, following Jesus, it is a life second to none. It's a life of peace with God. It's a life of deep and abiding joy in his presence. It's a life of great purpose and power and hope. But it's also not ultimately about you. It's about knowing Jesus, and it's about making him known. And being filled with that kind of life will always leave you satisfied. Look now at verses 37 and 38. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 7 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. Those who ate were 4,000 men, besides women and children. First, Jesus heals them all. Then Jesus feeds them all. And they were satisfied, the text says. It doesn't just mean filled. It means stuffed to the gills. It means packed full. It means fattened. And then beyond that, we're told that even after they've been stuffed and fattened with food, still there was extra left over, and they took up 7 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. And here we have, really briefly, one last clue to confirm that these are Gentiles. Because the kind of baskets mentioned here are different from the former feeding, the feeding of the 5,000. In the feeding of the 5,000, the word for the baskets that held the extra bread and fishes, the word was a specifically Jewish word for a kind of basket. They were sort of like lunch boxes. They were smaller. They were like hand baskets that the Jews used to carry Levitically clean food while traveling in Samaria or in other Gentile territories. So those were, in that part, those were the baskets that were filled up there. But here in our story, the word for the baskets that are filled up with extra food, it's a different word, and it describes a larger provision basket or a hamper. It's actually the kind of basket that we're told was used for letting Paul down over the wall at Damascus in Acts 9:25, a much bigger basket. But aside from, again, pointing to their identity as a Gentile crowd, what does this tell us? It tells us that all their needs were met far more abundantly than all that was asked or imagined. So that here, Jesus takes the children's bread and he shows there is more than enough to satisfy the Gentiles too. Here, Jesus gives his disciples a picture of the promise that he spoke to the centurion back in chapter 8. I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. Here to highlight and apply as broadly as possible the truth that he is more than enough for the world, we see that in Jesus there is also more than enough bread for the Gentiles. In Jesus, there is more than enough power. In Jesus, there is more than enough compassion. And in Jesus, there is more than enough bread to go around. Jesus takes a few small loaves. Jesus takes a few bits of fish, and he keeps breaking pieces off. He keeps breaking pieces off. He keeps breaking pieces off. The divine Son of God is interacting with physical matter in such a way that it multiplies, in such a way that it not only feeds, but satisfies a crowd of 4,000 men plus women and children, something like 10 to 15,000 people in all. In Jesus, there is more than enough bread to go around. Alfred Edersheim points out something at this point that I think is both beautiful and true. He points out that three times Jesus seems to have marked the end of an important stage of his ministry by setting a meal before his people. The first time came with the feeding of the 5,000 at the end of a first stage of ministry that was focused in Galilee. Yes, Jesus is going to go back to Galilee, but it's going to be briefly. His work there is wrapping up. It's coming to an end at this point. The second time, the second meal, comes with this feeding of the 4,000, which marks the end of a short but important stage of symbolic ministry among the Gentiles. As we've just said, this second feeding is meant to be an intentional mirror image of the first, of that first feeding. And taken together, those first two feedings, Edersheim believes both of these first two meals are meant to point us forward to a third meal, to a third meal that Jesus will set before his people, the meal that marks the nearing end of his ministry in suffering flesh, the Last Supper, the Last Supper. Commentator R.T. France agrees. He points out that the four verbs Matthew uses here in verse 36, look at verse 36. There's four verbs there that he uses to describe what Jesus does with the bread and with the fish. He took, he gave thanks, he broke, and he gave. All of these four verbs, he notes, are all used in the exact same sequence in all the miraculous feeding stories in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as well as in all three accounts of the Last Supper recorded in the same Gospels. What does that mean? What does that mean? That means that it was done on purpose, is what that means. It means that Matthew, as well as the other Gospel writers, it means they all understood that these feeding miracles of Jesus were intentional types. They were intentional pictures. They were intentional foretastes of what we now call communion or the Lord's Supper. They understood that these were foretastes of a sacrament, of an ordinance that would be passed down for centuries in the worship of the church. An ordinance that itself is a picture to remind us of something else, the body of Jesus broken for the world. The bread of life broken for the Jews and broken for the Gentiles too. In Jesus, there is more than enough bread to go around. Friends, the world is not just faint. The world is already dead in their trespasses and sins. They cannot make it home without Jesus. Jews and Gentiles alike have only one hope, and that is to feed on Jesus by faith. To feed on Jesus by faith is to hear and to believe the good news that in Jesus, God took on flesh to walk in our shoes. It's to hear and believe that in his lifetime among us, he did many wonderful things, like feed the hungry, like heal the sick. But it's also to understand that all of those human needs that Jesus encountered were always meant to point to a deeper need. And that all of the ways that Jesus met those needs were always meant to point to a deeper way that he had come to save. And that ultimate way he'd come to save us was to be the substitute for us. And so to feed on Jesus by faith is to believe that his life as a human satisfied all God's requirements on you as a human in a way that covered all your imperfections, that covered all your failures in life. It's to believe that in his bodily life, Jesus carried out with perfect obedience all of God's commands that you have failed to do, and that he did this for you so that you wouldn't have to answer to God for your failure. To feed on Jesus by faith is to believe that his death on a cross pays for all of the sin that you're ashamed of once and for all. And it's to take in and it's to trust the truth that in Jesus you're forgiven. The slate is wiped clean. And when you trust him in this way, you are given Jesus himself. You are joined to him forever so that his life is your life, so that his death is your death, and so that his resurrection life is your resurrection life too, a life of sustained satisfaction in him. And every time we celebrate communion together, it's a reminder of this. It's a reminder that this one body of Jesus, the bread of life, was broken for the Jews and broken for the Gentiles and broken for you too if you will trust him. In Jesus, there is more than enough bread to go around. Let's pray.